concluded Good Morning Wavy York. That's njwec.org. Or go to, or should I say and go to Public Banking Institute. Great information. And it's made possible on this commercial-free listener-sponsored radio station. 62 years, just celebrated a birthday a couple of days ago. 62 years of commercial-free broadcasting. 7 o'clock here in New York City. Coming up next, What's Going On with Bob Henley.
Mother, there's too many of you crying. Brother, there's far too many of you dying. Don't punish me with brutality. Talk to me so you can see.
Good morning, New York and New Jersey, as well as the great world beyond. This is the Chief Leader's Bob Henley at Stuck Nation, because we surely are. This is WBAI's Drive Time News Magazine, What's Going On? And I am your Monday morning, back to work, back to school host. Our focus is always labor. It's just after 7 a.m., January 24th. Michael G. Haskins is our audio engineer, and Linda Perry is our executive producer. Sunrise will be at 7:13. No rain or snow today, but our high will only be in the low 30s. Tomorrow will be in the same weather pattern, but we'll hit the mid-40s. Wednesday is sunnier, but it won't do much good with the temperatures in the teens to mid-20s all day. By Friday, things cloud up with a good chance of snow on the weekend. Oh, joy. This morning, we'll be speaking with City Council member Gail Brewer, former Manhattan Borough President, who was recently named to lead the city's powerful Committee on Oversight and Investigations, as well as New York City public advocate Jumaane Williams, who is also running for governor. And of course, your calls at 212-209-2877. But first, the Pacifica Network News.
Welcome to 2022 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
If you give government the license to silence its critics, you have given them the capacity to commit any atrocity they want.
Robert F. Kennedy Jr., the son of the slain U.S. Senator, spoke at a Defeat the Mandate rally in Washington, D.C., where thousands of opponents of COVID vaccine mandates gathered. The protesters included people who are pro-vaccine but anti-mandate, and some opposed to both. The event was held in a city that recently mandated an indoor vaccine requirement for those 12 and older. D.C. Mayor Muriel Bowser.
We have to be sure to get tested when we need to be tested to get vaccinated. And those are the ways back to a more normal life.
White House Chief Medical Advisor Dr. Anthony Fauci predicts the surge of cases caused by the Omicron variant will peak by mid-February. On Sunday, Fauci said the best case scenario will be to bring the virus under control with vaccines and tests and learn to live with it. Secretary of State Antony Blinken says the U.S. and its allies are preparing to counter Russia if it invades Ukraine. UK intelligence suggests Moscow wants to replace that nation's government with a pro-Russia leader. The Kremlin denies the charge, but Britain is shipping weapons to Ukraine. The House January 6th committee is investigating whether the Trump administration planned to have the military seize voting machines after the 2020 election. Chair Benny Thompson said the panel already discussed the matter with former Attorney General Bill Barr.
We're trying to march for life.
Events across the country marked Friday's 49th anniversary of the Supreme Court's landmark Roe v. Wade abortion rights decision. Legal observers say the conservative majority now in the court looks likely to uphold a Mississippi law banning abortions at 15 weeks. That's the home state of Republican Senator Cindy Hyde-Smith, who says it's the most significant opportunity to overturn Roe v. Wade in half a century.
Today, we march with greater hope and prayer for the Supreme Court to show grace to the unborn in the Dobbs case.
Counter rallies were also held.
Abortion, no!
If Roe is overturned, pro-choice groups expect abortion will become illegal in about 24 states. However, Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker pledged to make his state a refuge for reproductive rights.
Let's be loud and clear. Abortion restrictions endanger women. They force patients to travel tens, hundreds, thousands of miles, empty their savings accounts, or worst of all, turn to options that put their lives at risk.
Senator Kyrsten Sinema was censured Saturday by the Arizona Democratic Party. That vote came after Sinema joined fellow centrist Joe Manchin of West Virginia in blocking efforts to change the filibuster to pass voting rights legislation. After reaching record highs late last year, stock markets are down sharply this month. The declines came after the Federal Reserve said it would no longer be buying bonds under its quantitative easing program. I'm Mary Sherman for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our A-Trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
Thanks so much, Mary. This is Bob Henley. One of the things that we are seeing is this phrase that's in the top of the national newscast where Dr. Fauci is advising us to live with it. And on this program, because we're dedicated to labor, it's very important that we remind people that essential workers have been living and dying with it throughout. And so as we try to look at these data points locally, we do see that it's on the wane in the sense that Governor Hochul reported a drop off in new infections. It's also important to understand that same trend is seen in New Jersey. But nationally, we're still, as of Friday, talking about a couple of thousands of deaths a day across the country. And much of the country, particularly where we had such severe cutbacks in rural and urban areas and hospitals, the country is in the throes of a major public health crisis. So I do think it's important in this airwaves that when we're speaking to each other, that we be informed by that. And indeed, the idea of learning to live with it has to include making workers safe and learning basic things like, why did so many essential workers die? How many of them died and how many of them are still at risk? So that said, I just want to take this little musical break and then we'll be back with Gail Brewer.
When the union's inspiration through the workers' blood shall run, there can be no power greater anywhere beneath the sun. Yet what force on earth is weaker than the feeble strength of one? The union makes us strong. Solidarity forever. Solidarity forever. Solidarity forever. For the union makes us strong.
That rousing rendition of Solidarity Forever, thanks to the United Auto Workers. I am pleased to be joined on the line by City Council Member Gail Brewer, formerly of the Manhattan Borough Presidency, and then before that, the City Council. Good morning, Gail.
Good morning, Bob. This is a great pleasure.
Well, so listen, I want to ask you, over the weekend, we have, of course, had that tragic police shooting, police officer Jason Rivera, only 22. He had joined the department in November of 2020. He was killed. His partner, Wilbert Mora, was seriously wounded. They were responding to a 911 domestic disturbance call. The alleged shooter was shot twice. Apparently, he used some ungodly multi-round magazine that had no business being I don't know if it should be in anyone's hands. And then, of course, we had the weekend before that, the tragic story about Michelle Goh, an accomplished young woman, 40 years old, pushed to her death. She had volunteered for the homeless, and she was evidently, allegedly, pushed to her death by a homeless person, that the system failed. Gail, you've been in public life for a long time and a committed, one of my favorite committed public servants. What is going on? How does this fit in the narrative? I know that the statistics don't tell the whole story. What do you hear from people about what's happening on the streets and in the subways of New York?
Well, first of all, I just want to say, regarding the shooting of the police officers, I did go up to the hospital that night, and I got there around 8 o'clock. The second floor of the Harlem Hospital, to the credit of the police department, there wasn't an inch that wasn't held by police officers. You could hear a pin drop. It was that kind of it just support for each other and horror at what had just happened. At that point, we didn't know whether it was one or two persons who had been killed. We obviously found out it was one, and the other gentleman, as you indicated, is in critical. That night, I think, for all of us who were there, will never be forgotten. Of course, the horror happened right across the street from the hospital, not like it was far away. So the entire area was cordoned off. We then waited until the body was put into a police van and taken to the morgue. It was a night like none other. And I think the horror of it, like you said, has nothing to do with statistics. And the same thing with Michelle Goh. She lived on 72nd Street in my district. I know people who were on her board at the Junior League. I went to the rally, and her colleagues from Deloitte spoke in a way that everybody needed tissue. The last person to see her, I think, was a doorman at 50 West 72nd Street that morning, because she was actually, I think it was a weekend, and she was on her way to work. So this was a woman with unbelievable kindness, potential, intelligence. And then I think yesterday there was a pushing. Thank God the gentleman was not killed at Canal Street. He was pushed into the subway, but he was not killed because the train stopped by miracle. So, right, people are nervous on the subway. They're nervous on the street. I think, I don't know enough about the statistics on mental health, whether it's a pandemic, whether it's people have not been taking their medications as a result, or they just have extra mental health challenges. But that is coupled with the guns. And it's a, you know, it's a deadly combination. So what are we going to do about it? I have to give, I think Mayor Adams is the right mayor at this time because he has experience. We'll see what he comes out with in terms of his, he indicated that he's going to come out this week with a plan for safety. But I will say there's two things. The first issue is, I know this sounds like it's a long-term goal, but we have got to have social workers in the schools on a regular basis, and we have to have better mental health services. I did have 35 foster care kids over the years, and many of them had mental health issues. It's very hard to know who to turn to despite all the hot hotlines and opportunities. It's hard. You could see from the mother who called on 135th Street about her son who then shot the officers. She was asking for help, and the worst happened. But she didn't know what to do. So what I'm saying is the hope is that the mental health professionals and the police department can work together as they are doing in some of the precincts in Harlem. But in addition, the mayors around the country, I know that Mayor Adams just came from the U.S. Conference of Mayors, can think of a way to get rid of this, I call it the I-95 gun pipeline, the guns coming from other states. So if you need, I guess, short-term and long-term, but it's that combination of the guns, the mental health, and people who, you know, need services. It's a big challenge right now.
Well, and you have, with the granular detail that you always bring to your advocacy, you've painted a vivid portrait. If you'd call us, like to join in with observations, 212-209-2877. You can reach both Gail and I. Gail, we have been doing this for a long time. For mine as journalist, you as a public servant, elected official. We both, I think, remember a period of time where it became stated policy by the state of New York to close mental health facilities. And that came out of reporting by the first incarnation of Geraldo Rivera, who exposed all kinds of abuses within these places of people that needed, that had mental health issues. And what happened is the idea was we were going to open up community-based alternatives. Quite frankly, with a few exceptions, that never happened. And so I think in both of our professional lives, what's happened is people with mental health challenges are thrown into the buzzsaw of the New York City real estate market, which has been devoured by real estate interests, which make big contributions to elected officials and those who want to run for office. So in my lifetime, I mean, in a whole other lifetime back in the arts, I remember places like the Empire Hotel, where there was affordable housing. Much of that has been squeezed out by this ravenous, just this, don't really describe it, just this, it's corrosive and evil greed. And so can you make the connection between housing, and particularly housing that provides the supports that are required? I mean, that's where we really have a breakdown, don't we? We never really did build this infrastructure of community-based mental health facilities.
Absolutely, because when Geraldo Rivera was the reporter that closed Willowbrook, I think Hugh Carey was the governor at the time and certainly hasn't produced the community-based facilities. There are so many challenges. First of all, when people, thank goodness, or come home from upstate prisons. I don't know, it's maybe 5,000. I think it's a year. There are no alternatives to those who don't have a home to go to, so they go directly to the shelters with very little support. What should happen to those individuals? They should be given the opportunity to go directly to some of the places like Fortune and others, Exodus, wonderful organizations that support people who are coming out of incarceration. Right now, if you build a building that these organizations do and have affordable housing, they can only take people from the shelters. They cannot take individuals coming directly from upstate. So number one would be to change that scenario, because they would do peer-to-peer and they know how to work with these individuals and get them back on their feet. And they don't have any problems, no recidivism. All positive, number one. Number two, the real estate, like the Empire, that was a single-room occupancy. I remember when it closed. And all of the single-room occupancies on the Upper West Side and throughout Manhattan and other parts of the city, they are all now almost exclusively high-income condos or rentals. Even the hotels that exist in Midtown where we could purchase, we have two nonprofits that want to purchase. They did so under the de Blasio administration, but there's some law department statement and that has indicated the hotels cannot be converted until there's a piece of city council legislation that will allow them to go from hotel to permanent supportive housing. So we're having, Carlina Rivera has that bill, but why in the world the administration didn't get that off the books and into reality before, I don't know. We have to take some of these hotels that are now vacant and working with the city of New York, purchase them and convert them to affordable housing. That's just a one step that could be of assistance. And then second, we have to figure out how to even be more aggressive about not, you know, about finding ways so people do not get evicted. We all know that the eviction moratorium is over. We don't want more people added to the shelter roles and to the homeless. So this is a moment in time right now. Purchase hotels and find a way to really make sure that people stay in their homes. That's, you know, we also have to find ways, as the mayor has indicated and the governor has indicated, people are going to be coming off of the subway. We'll see if that happens. We hope it does. But where are they going to go? Are they going to Safe Havens, which are sort of intermediary locations? These folks are not going to go to a shelter.
So one of the things is that you are in this I can't think of a better person, quite frankly, to have be involved with oversights and investigations. We, you do know, because you keep track of it, we spend billions of dollars on mental health and homeless issues. And it's often given to nonprofits. And this show serves, we have, because of my work at the Chief, we have a lot of civil servants that listen. They have watched as the city has spent billions of dollars. And the problem, it's almost, I call it homeless ink. The problem doesn't get better. And sometimes the way they're dealing with it, are you interested in looking at from your position at how we are spending this money? And particularly because you've identified some great goals, but we know that Washington is not a reliable partner. They can't do Build Back Better. They can't do voting rights. So is this, are these a constellation of issues you might look at?
Of course, because one of the challenges during the de Blasio administration was he wanted to build 90 temporary shelters. I really want a permanent supportive housing. It would make a huge difference. And also to support the what I indicated for places like Fortune and Exodus to deal with people who are coming from upstate after incarceration. Yes, absolutely. We need this permanent affordable housing. Take some of that money that's going to the temporary housing and use it for permanent. It's not as easy as doing that because you have to, you know, there's some state and federal money involved in the temporary right. housing. So how do you convert that to permanent? These are some of the issues that we absolutely have to address. The answer to your question is yes.
Well, great. Anyway, you're proved very popular on the line, Gail. We have some callers in. Caller, please identify where you're calling from, your name, and what are you concerned about?
How you doing? My name is Mo Willie Oliveri. Some folks call me Mo. I've called before. I'm a New York City teacher on unpaid leave. I'm concerned about understanding if your show and other shows on DAI will cover the Defeat the Mandate march that happened on Washington, D.C. yesterday, where renowned doctors, Dr. Ryan Cole, Peter McCullough, Christina Parker came out against the mandates in New York City. It was a huge turnout. Some of the numbers that I'm seeing is about 50,000 people were in Washington, D.C. protesting the mandates. And I'm listening to these radio programs to understand if any coverage will happen.
So, excuse me, caller, what time did you tune into our program today?
I tuned in at about 7. Maybe if
okay, so did you hear Robert F. Kennedy Jr., make his statement regarding the danger of suppressing dissent in society that was from that rally?
I did not hear that.
That was a very prominent part at the top of the newscast, just so you know.
Thank you for that, because I do feel like there's two worlds going on, so I'm listening to see if WBAI and your show, which I've now been made aware of, and I love the topic that you talk about. I want to see that these topics are being brought about. If they're not being spoken about on your mainstream media, at least I'm hoping that the AI in your show would at least give some voice to what's happening in the streets in New York, in America.
And please call again and also direct message me, and you can reach me through the Chief. Thanks so much, caller. We have been discussing extensively in the Chief about all that's been going on with mandates and the different models of how to get workforces to work with management. And there's different models than the course of mandate, as we had Sarah Nelson on from the flight attendants for the CWA who worked with United, where management and the unions work together to roll out these workplace safety issues. Gail, I did want to ask you to comment. There is a lot of concern in the civil service about the level to which we learned from the pandemic. Is there any chance the council will take a look at it? We know that at least 400 civil servants from New York City alone have died from the pandemic. Is that something you're concerned about? Is how well prepared are we for, heaven forbid, the next pandemic?
Yes, absolutely. There's actually a subcommittee that I'm on that is going to, it's just called COVID, and that's exactly what it's going to look at. What are the ways in which we did or didn't work well in terms of COVID with the workforce, and what should we be doing in the future? I think it's still confusing to people, though. I know daycare centers, childcare centers are still confused. Parents are still confused. To the credit of the Chancellor Banks, he's had a couple of Zooms with all the elected officials, and the main issue is confusion about what it is or isn't in terms of the schools and testing and days that you need to quarantine, et cetera. So it's not just how to prevent and keep us safe, but it's once you have, as you suggested, different models, what are the models and how do they work? So I think there's just a lot of questions generally, and parents are really confused.
Well, and I'm glad you're going to be there to help make sure that people have a chance to ask them and be heard. We have another caller online. Caller, where are you calling from? What's your name and what's your concern?
Italiano from Riverdale. I've got about a dozen thoughts. I'll get them off real quick. Today in the city, if you're not making $80,000 and up, and you're not a couple and you have a second salary, you're pretty much going to have a hard time renting a place, which makes you homeless or a roommate. So that's very easy to point out or figure out who is where and when. Then from school, you could figure out who's going to go into, who has the drive and stays in step to make the $80,000 and get into fields and above. $60,000 is not going to cut an $1,800 a month apartment or $1,700 apartment. You're basically homeless. As far as the dwellings, it's not just hotels. You have to take the office space that's now empty and convert that.
Good point.
Yeah, that's right. And then who is going to take care? Because you can't make this thing a pigsty. So these people have now reached a point where they have mental illness. They're not going to clean their apartment. What's going to be the system to do that? That's why people don't want homeless shelters in their neighborhood, because they become a mess. People bring things in with a cart. They, you know, their whole apartment becomes a mess. So you have to have that system. Now, as far as safety on for women, they need to join public society and be much more aware when they walk around. Stop being on their cell phone all the time and just glimpsing. The cell phone has made them more antisocial in public society, in my opinion. You just observe this. They don't know what to do when they come to a building about how to handle a door. Do I open it? Am I courteous?
May I ask you a question?
When they're on a platform, please allow me. When they're on a platform, you have to be aware. This woman was pushed on the platform probably because she wasn't paying attention.
Can I ask you a question? Can I ask you a question? Caller. Hello? Caller? Is the caller still there? Hello?
Hello.
I'm still here. Are you still there?
Yes, I'm still here. Yep.
Excellent. So for whatever reason, the call just faded out. That happens in the magic of mystery during a pandemic. So, Gail, he raised some interesting questions there. I had wanted to ask him about whether or not he sounded like he had a law enforcement background. It is true that people do go around insulated from their surroundings, and often, and we don't know, I don't know what happened particularly with the tragedy of Michelle Goh, but what that is something people do need to be aware. It sounds basic, but we are in a situation where people are increasingly used to having headphones when they walk around in public.
Well, it's men and women, because obviously I'm, as elected official, I'm often at the subway. You hand out PPE, et cetera. And many people you can't talk to. You can't even say hello because they have their earbuds in and they're listening to their music or whatever. So I take the subway and I'm very conscious of not being on my cell phone because I am paying attention. However, it's men and women, and you shouldn't get pushed. Just basically, though, you should not get pushed. So you should be able to listen to your phone and not be pushed. So I want to say I would disagree with them in the sense that we need to have both. You need to pay attention, but people who do this should not be in the subways.
Right. And I guess the thing I wanted to ask you is, what do you advise people to do? Because you know how the city works better than anyone I know. If you come across someone who is clearly having a crisis in real time when you're in the subway. You know, and you're not trained as a mental health professional, what should people do? What's a good thing of conscience to do?
Yeah, I mean, obviously you pay attention. I do tend to look for, because there isn't a identified social worker or caseworker, or I have yet to see, I know Bowery Project has the contract with the city of New York to do homeless outreach, which is perhaps different than mental health. Sometimes they go together, sometimes they don't. But the point is, you have to find somebody to say this person is acting in a way that could be violent. If somebody is not violent, I don't know, or acting violent or potentially violent, that's the only way that this Kendra's Law kicks in. So I would only probably bring it to the attention of authority if I could find somebody, or somebody from the MTA if I thought somebody was going to be violent. Otherwise, you know, right now there are a lot of people in the subway either going through the subway or, you know, acting on the platform, sleeping on the benches and so on, where they're not acting in a way that is threatening. But you never know, because this is the mental health kicks in, mental health challenges kick in.
Well, I was wondering if you could provide the coordinates for people that have come up with something they think needs investigation. What's the channel they should use to reach you?
It would be, the phone number is 212-873-0282, and the email is just gbrewer@council.nyc. So it's very easy, and it's all on our website, this Gail Brewer City Council.
When is your first hearing?
We don't have a date yet. It'll be early February, but we don't have a date yet.
Thank you so much for helping us navigate what is a really difficult time in New York City. I feel optimistic. It seems like we have some capable leadership at the helm, but there are a lot of things that haven't been addressed for a very long time.
Absolutely true, and thank you so much, Bob.
All right, take care. That was Gail Brewer, who is the city council member who's been tapped to be chair of the Oversight and Investigations Committee. We'll be following that very closely. We'll take a little musical break. We'll be back with Jumaane Williams and your calls at 212-209-2877. Rousing way, make you feel a little warmer as you try to bundle up to go out there and face the cruel cold January. I'm glad it's cold in January. I'm so privileged and honored to be joined by public advocate Jumaane Williams, who's on the line right now. Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning, Bob. How are you?
Great. So I did go over with your colleague, Gail Brewer, the details, and she gave some update related to the tragedy that happened in Harlem with the shooting of the police officer, Jason Rivera, 22 years old. He died. His partner is in very critical condition, Wilbert Mora. And then we did talk about the tragedy the weekend before with Michelle Goh being pushed to her death on the R train. What is your sense? I mean, you have the background of the city council and community activism, you know what's happening in the city of New York. You've been paying very close attention throughout the pandemic on a granular level. I've benefited a lot from the Zoom calls you've had with Dr. Celine Gounder and now Borough President Mark Levine. Where are we? How would you characterize what's happening in the streets and subways?
No, thank you. Of course, we're all in both officers' families are in our prayer, and we're praying for the officer critical condition. I also want to add the 11-month-old baby shot in the cheek, spent her birthday in surgery, but thankfully she seems to will be pulling out of that. I think we are in a very interesting time. I don't think we are where we were in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, so we have to be clear about that so we don't get the hysteria that comes with it. I'm asking folks not to make policy based on headlines. But we are in a serious position where there are crimes going up and we can't ignore it. We have an opportunity to do something different than we did when this happened 3 or 4 decades ago, when there was a response that people apologized for decades later, a response that didn't actually help the way people thought it would, and it caused more trauma to communities. And I've been a leading voice on public safety in the council and public advocate for a very long time. And we've put out reports, we've put out ideas, and some of them have been adopted. And when they're adopted, they show that they work. And too many of them have been ignored. And it's got us to this point.
So that is, and it's important to point into perspective that you have, I guess, at one point when I first started working as a reporter, 2,000 some odd homicides a year back in the period of time of the 80s. And it's true historically, people are concerned, and rightfully so, when we get over 400. Are you still there, counsel, a public advocate, Trani? Yeah, I said you faded out for a bit there. Your cells, it's a little corrupted, the sound. Can you hear me now?
Yes, I can hear you. I'm still here.
Great. So, as I pointed out, you're so right about that historically. Mayor Adams pointed out that the federal government has really not stepped up here in terms of illegal gun traffic. Can you talk about the history of that? Because it appears that New York City is very much on its own when it comes to stopping the flow of what, like this multi bullet chamber that was used, is allegedly used in the shooting of the police officer. I mean, certainly the federal government has a responsibility here when it comes to the flow and proliferation of guns.
That's absolutely right. First of all, gun violence is a public health issue. We've talked about gun violence in two different ways, the supply and the demand, and we failed kind of on both of those. The supply is really the federal government that has to step up to deal with the access to guns that we have in this country. I think people don't fully understand. We have 4% of the world's population, and over half of all civilian-owned guns are in this country. And every illegal gun was legal at some point. And so the federal government has just failed miserably when it comes to access to guns and the amount of access that we have. And that's correct what the mayor is saying. It just has to be more to do. There's more to do, a lot more to do when it comes to that. And then on the demand side, it's trying to make sure we are changing the communities and the folks who use the guns to communicate in the first place. And at that point, we had actually started doing better, which is why we got to the levels we got in 2018 and 2019, which were almost unsustainable, people thought. One of the things we didn't do was structuralize and fully resource the things that were working. And as we battled to try to do that, we got hit with the pandemic. These are not excuses, by the way. You have to have accountability for shooting up a neighborhood, and shooting an 11-year-old, and shooting an 11-month-old, and shooting an officer. What we have to do is spend at least as much, if not more, of our energy into preventing it from happening in the first place. And we have sometimes trouble communicating that. And my hope is with the interagency task force and that we really focus on the trafficking of the gun. And then remember, we had a few years with the president who didn't even allow the CDC to do research when it comes to gun violence.
Right. And that, I guess the key thing here is also there's an intersectionality. I know that it's a buzzword, but in this case, when you have mental health challenges and you have, as we were saying before in the earlier segment, the state actually closing facilities for generations, making a commitment it never kept to develop community-based facilities. And then you have on top of that a shelter crisis. I mean, can you address that? There's a nexus here, isn't there?
There's a lot of intersectionality on a lot of these issues. And when we talk about mental health, similarly to where you talk about how to address some of this violence, if you don't build out the infrastructure to address these things, then we know what's going to happen. And when you look at mental health, we put out a report, I believe it was maybe a year and a half ago, about what we can do to address the mental health crisis in this city. That was, unfortunately, a lot of it was ignored by the last administration. There were some pieces that were adopted, and they're working well, which we're glad to see. But we've got so much resistance around this issue, around building the infrastructure, simply saying, support us in getting a three-digit number that people can call. I heard you talking to the council member about what folks can do. We said we should put on a three-digit number where people can call so they don't get a criminal response.
Right.
Right now, the largest mental health facility is Rikers Island in North America. That's a problem. The fact that we can't get long-term care after someone gets an assistance. My sister, who works in Harlem, unfortunately, was mayor to where the officer was shot. On her way to work, as she was driving, someone spit on both sides of her car, and she realized the person had mental health issues. Her question to me was, she wants the person to not be there and get the assistance they need, but she doesn't want them to go to Rikers. What can she do? Unfortunately, my answer is usually very limited in that case, because we don't have the infrastructure there. And so when we don't have it, we generally rely on the police to fix all the problems and gaps that we have. And that leads to a lot of problems. It's unfair for the officer, and certainly unfair to the person and the communities we're trying to help.
Well, and you raise a good point, because so often as the chief leader, we get calls from people of conscience in the civil service, whether it be the MTA, station agents, people that are, you know, working throughout the system, and they're compassionate people, and they are presented with exactly the Hobson's choice you described, where someone is doing behavior that is going to hurt themselves or others, and they're afraid and they hesitate from calling the police. And so I guess it seems to me there needs to be a middle ground where people can call a rapid response that doesn't necessarily involve a gun.
That's correct. Our police, who I always remember, always, if something dangerous happens right now, we want them to run into danger while we run away. And they do. And that's what Officer Rivera and his partner did. And they'll do it again, even after a tragic happens like this. But they also only have a certain set of tools that they can use, and those tools are not applicable to every situation that we try to send them to. And even in fairness to them, we shouldn't be putting them in the situations that we keep putting them in. There should be a rapid response that we can call to get someone the health services that they need, not the criminal response services that we've been providing them. And that just doesn't exist in the way that it should. We also have been using hospital beds for people who need this assistance. We also have never invested in the long-term care. There was a lot of money spent on Thrive NYC. There's a universal agreement. It didn't have the effect that we wanted. Now, what it did do is it helped raise the conversation, which is important. But for the money that was spent, I think there was so much more that we could have accomplished in the past few years. And my hope is that with the new administration, even with the new administration in the state, we can really invest in this, because we actually know it works. But too often we get caught up in feeding the fear and responding to the fear with responses that don't help, when we can take this opportunity to have the courage to put in a response to the action that help.
And that, it sounds to me, this is a perfect segue in essence. It's widely known that you're running for governor. A lot of these issues, while they are playing out in New York City, they do have a lot to do with what's happening in Albany. What inspired you to do that? Like, in terms of what is your vision for the state of New York?
Well, one, you know, I sometimes get so disappointed when I hear leaders say that we want to return to normal. And in my view, normal didn't work for most folks in most cases. And had we addressed normal before the pandemic, we might not have gotten as bad as we did. So we want a state that is not going to go back to normal. And as you mentioned, these issues are happening all across the state. And I've seen it. And I've spoken to people from Brooklyn to Buffalo that have been looking for Albany to provide the leadership that's needed. And what I found is that if we can get these cities to be working together to combat these issues, there's so much more we could be doing. I'm very so proud to be the public advocate of the city of New York, and I thank the voters for supporting me. But one of the reasons I decided to run is because, as I mentioned, I've been a leading voice in these issues for the past decade, and I thought it was time to be in a position to actually do the thing that we've been advocating for, because sometimes, too often, we don't have the right leader in there who has the courage to push forward and actually get it done. And it's, we're in a time period now that's unique, that we can remember people we lost by not going back to normal.
Right. And I guess the other thing, too, is that we're also, when you think what's happening in Washington, they can't even, we have the Democratic Party, even though it nominally controls the Senate, couldn't even pass a vital voting rights bill. And Build Back Better was just blown up. So I guess it does really shift the attention and the potential, both to City Hall and to Albany. One of the things that benefits of having a campaign is that you can articulate an alternative vision. You mentioned, I think I saw it in some of the stuff that was put out after Governor Hochul's, I guess, the state of the state and budget address. You were concerned about the not picking up the eviction moratorium. Can you give us a little detail about that? I mean, that means some folks are in some harm's way here.
It's been stunning to see some of and hear some of the things that come out from the new second floor. You know, the governor's mentioned in the state of the state, which hit some good points. I was stunned because it actually could have been given before the pandemic. And I didn't really feel like it was a speech that met the moment where we were. Housing was one of those points where it was clear to me that there is neither a understanding of the grasp of where we are with housing and homelessness, or we just don't have the capability or the courage to meet it. And the eviction moratorium, combined with not even supporting a good cause, having nothing in place to prevent foreclosures from our small homeowners, particularly those who are owner-occupied. And then on top of that, the plan to build 100,000 new units build or preserve all across the state, and 100,000 probably wouldn't be enough for one of the boroughs, is just stunning to me. And to possibly have tens of thousands of people get evicted doing this in the middle of winter, in the middle of Omicron, is just the height of irresponsibility.
And it's interesting, too. You've been keeping track of Omicron, like I said, because of the public advocate's role. It must have been a great challenge because you maintain constituent service. And I know occupational health for your workforce was important. How did you balance those? I mean, it's an ongoing challenge.
It always is an ongoing challenge, but we do our best to follow the science, and we do our best to make sure we maintain service and protection for the people who work there. And we figured it was also important to show change in behavior, because when government doesn't show change in behavior, it's hard to say that New Yorkers should. And so we went remote pretty early. We're remote now. We actually have come back to the office in a hybrid model, which is going to be the model of the future, and we should actually take leadership in framing that. But we will come back to a hybrid model really soon. But we found that people are invested in the work that they were doing, and we have to give them the latitude to be safe and to work. And so we're proud of the work that we've done, and we're going to continue doing that. And when we come back, we will be coming back in a high-level model, which is where I believe that we're going to be headed toward anyway.
You do know that throughout the civil service, because you're in touch with a lot of people, the ranges have really been dramatic with different agencies. Some agencies promoting one level of concern for the workforce and others not so much. I mean, that's the thing that I'm struck by, because it's the chief who've been reporting on it. You can understand, certainly, I mean, around the country, even now, we don't even know how many essential workers have died as a result of this virus.
You know, it was also stunning to hear that one of the first things out of the governor's mouth is trying to force people back to work. And that just, again, was just tone deaf of where we are. And I understand that we do need people to come back to work. But we have to understand, one, we're not where we were before this pandemic. And so I agree that we have to get folks into downtown areas so that their businesses can just continue to thrive. I also have to understand people have learned that you can work from home, and we have to create this hybrid model that works for everybody. We also understand that not everybody can work from home, even in the best of situations. So there should be compensation attached, I believe, to some of these things to try to balance things out. But what you're saying is correct, and I think it's that lack of leadership that we didn't have all throughout this pandemic, and where we have tried to be a voice to fill the gaps in leadership that was occurring. And we have an awesome workforce here in the city. And I'm not sure throughout this pandemic that we've really honored that voice in the way we feel. We've called people essential, but often treat them as expendable. And I would say the people who seem to be most expendable live in the communities that were hit the hardest by the pandemic.
So true. Thank you so much, Public Advocate Jermoni Williams. We hope to be speaking with you soon.
Thank you so much for having me. It's always a pleasure. Thank you.
Take care. That was Public Advocate Jermoni Williams, who is running for governor.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right.
That's right. Thank goodness that Michael G. Haskins is so quick on the draw. All of a sudden, the cyber gods decided that Zoom wouldn't work, so I'm back to you now. I just wanted to make sure we closed out with asking you all please to call 212-209-2877 and support this kind of programming. 212-209-2877. I've got 5 copies of Stuck Nation, Can the United States Change Course on Our History of Choosing Profits Over People? And to someone that makes a $100 donation to the station, I will personally, that's me, address it, inscribe it, and then send it to you. Please call in 212-209-2877. Democracy Now! Is next. Stay tuned for Frenchie Davis tomorrow in this time slot.
Talk to me. You can't see what's going on. Yeah, what's going on? Tell me what's going on. I'll tell you what's going on. Ooh.
Right on. Right on. Right on.
I'm Dr. Anthony Leizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Dangerous wildfires, heavy downpours, damaging floods. As the climate warms, many parts of the U.S. are in growing danger from extreme events. It would make sense for people to start moving out of the most vulnerable areas, but a report from the real estate company Redfin shows that the opposite is happening. From 2016 through 2020, more people moved to high-risk areas than low-risk areas.
People were actually leaving some of the places with the lower climate risk. These tend to be places in the Midwest, the Rust Belt, that have had less economic prosperity, and they're tending to move to areas in the Sun Belt, so Florida, Texas, Arizona, Nevada.
Daryl Fairweather is Redfin's chief economist. She says people are often lured by warmer winters or new economic opportunities. Others are leaving areas such as San Francisco that lack affordable housing.
And what happens is that people get pushed further and further away from the city center into Central California that has high fire risk.
So from people searching for affordability to those seeking warmer winters, a growing number of people are in the path of increasingly extreme weather. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
What's going on over at WBAI at 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web? Bob Henley, Mondays at 7 a.m., made possible by listeners just like you. 62 years of commercial-free broadcasting.